Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Tuesday morning. It's July 21st. Let's see. Currently, we have got partly cloudy skies out there. 69 degrees currently in Old Town Park City. Heber City reporting 70 degrees. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, it's meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Tuesday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Tuesday. As we go throughout today, we are going to be looking at some of that monsoon moisture pushing towards the north. And that's going to give us a pretty good chance of seeing scattered showers and thunderstorms. Of course, the best chance of these showers and thunderstorms will come this afternoon, where we could see some heavy downpours, of course, frequent lightning, and yes, even the potential of some isolated strong wind gusts. But of course, no doubt about it, the greatest threat that we're going to be most concerned about is that elevated flash flood threat as we go into this afternoon hour. So keep an eye to the sky. Make sure you have a way to get weather notifications just in case. Temperatures will climb into the upper 80s to near 90 in Park City for your afternoon hours on this Tuesday. We'll be in the mid-90s in the Heber Valley. As we make our way into your Wednesday, we're going to keep a really good chance of those scattered showers and thunderstorms in the forecast, and an elevated flood threat will continue throughout your Wednesday. So again, it will be another day where we will need to be weather aware as we go throughout the day. Temperatures will climb only into the low 80s in Park City. We'll see those highs only in the upper 80s in the Heber Valley. Once we move towards your Thursday, look for partly cloudy skies. We'll have a chance of a few more isolated showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon hours. But overall, we'll start to see those rain chances decreasing by your Thursday. Temperatures will be in the mid-80s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs right around 90 in the Heber Valley. Once we make our way into your Friday, your Pioneer Day, well, it's looking much improved. How about mostly sunny skies? Just a very slight chance of a shower popping up. But for the most part, it's looking fairly dry. Temperatures start to warm back up. So we'll be seeing those high temperatures back into the upper 80s in Park City. High temperatures will climb back into the lower 90s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your upcoming weekend, the heat will be back with us. Upper 80s for your Saturday and Sunday in Park City, with partly cloudy skies and a slight chance of an isolated storm redeveloping. The Heber Valley, we're looking at partly cloudy skies with an isolated storm and highs in the mid-90s. Let's look at your latest forecast of the Wasatch back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up this morning, I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaum. No meeting this week, but we'll talk about some of the other issues taking place in the Wasatch County. Also, unfortunately, Greg Durso, an adaptive mountain biker, unable to join us this morning. But the co-founder of the Kelly Brush Foundation, Kelly Brush, will be calling in with details about a special screening of the film in which Greg is the subject of, Best Day Ever. It's taking place Saturday at Park City Films Jim Santee Auditorium. And later on, Recycle Utah Executive Director Andy Hecht in with the latest from the Recycling Center. Taking a look at local news now, Wasatch County has a new roadmap to guide its land use and development decisions. KPCW's Grace Dorthel reports a year and a half of work went into that general plan update.
Wasatch County's general plan includes everything from transportation needs to environmental resources to housing strategy. At a meeting July 15th, council members finalized the first comprehensive update of the document in 25 years. A lot has changed for the community since 2001. The population has more than doubled, housing costs have soared, and the economy's focus has turned to resorts. Assistant Planning Director Austin Query said one goal of the update was to make the plan accessible to county residents. Another was to set policies based on what matters to the community.
Those policies that you set should be grounded solidly in values that the community wants to protect.
Valuing the county's rural heritage, for instance, might mean a policy of concentrating new growth near existing cities and towns. Query met with each municipality to discuss how the general plan could affect them. The county also had open houses, surveys, comment periods, and many meetings over the past year and a half. County Manager Dustin Graybaugh said the new document reflects what matters most to residents.
I think this is an amazing representation of the community values that Austin and our team has put together over the last 18 months.
Query recommended an annual report so leaders can gauge whether they're meeting the general plan goals and course correct if needed. He added the county will continue to update the document as it implements the plan.
What do you do once you hit that goal? You should go back and readdress the plan and say, well, what's our new goal then? Not leave the plan saying we did it already.
To learn more about the county's new general plan, visit kpcw.org. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Basin Recreation plans to ask voters to approve up to $150 million in new debt to triple its fitness offerings with two new buildings. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on that.
The two field houses Basin Rec is proposing to build will have rock climbing and aquatics facilities, but not just that. The Recreation District has published draft floor plans. While it waits for the Summit County Council to put a property tax bond question on the November ballot, voters will be asked to approve up to $150 million in bonds to pay for the new buildings. District Director Robert Parrish says residents told his staff that their initial blueprints weren't big enough. He says taxpayers have so far told the district that if they build new facilities, they need to do it right.
You know, one of the things I think we are looking at internally is, okay, if we scale back and go to the smaller facilities that we were planning back in May, what's that cost difference? And really, the difference between, let's say, $125 million bond for two facilities versus $150 is really only about $25 a year in property tax valuation for the median home within the district, which is $1.3 million.
The full $150 million would cost the median home about $250 annually. The bigger of the two facilities would be in Silver Creek Village. At 120,000 square feet, it will house a lap and recreation pool, indoor turf field, running track, space for camps, and youth fitness. The 64,000 square foot facility near Jeremy Ranch will have bouldering, top rope speed climbing, a smaller track, and indoor multipurpose courts. Both facilities would include weight training and cardio equipment, as well as child care facilities. Child care is one of the areas in which Basin Rec may partner with other organizations to operate the field houses.
We would look at a public-private partnership where somebody else would build out the interior of the climbing facility and run it for us, and we would not have to pay for the operations and maintenance of that. We're doing something similar with, I've had negotiations with PC Tots. One of the things we've heard from community members is they'd like to have drop-in daycare so they can come and work out.
The existing field house in Kimball Junction is about 87,000 square feet. County Council member Chris Robinson has questioned what expansion would do to Basin Rec's operating costs.
Because I could easily see if this bond were to pass and the facilities built that you would be financially crimped by having greater operating costs and be coming back for more.
Parrish says that's exactly why Basin Rec is auditing its fees and membership rates. He says the district is undercharging for some services and overcharging for others.
In looking at our cost recovery model based on similar recreation districts along with the national average, our fee recovery is actually less than what it should be. We're probably at about the 25 to 30% cost recovery.
If Basin adds two field houses, he anticipates reexamining both membership and program fees to make sure they're fair and high enough. Non-residents and visitors would pay elevated rates since they wouldn't be paying off the bonds through property taxes. Basin Rec's overarching goal is to plan ahead for new growth. The district also says future residents will offset the financial burden on current residents. That's assuming voters approve the bonds November 3rd. Basin Rec is a financial supporter of KPCW. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Well, the Wasatch County Council won't meet for the rest of the month, but there's still lots going on. On the phone is Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybaugh. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with the news that the county has adopted its general plan. This, again, is the first plan since 2001. So can you kind of summarize what changes going forward?
Yeah, so our general plan that we adopted in 2001, well, that was the last time we did a comprehensive overview, and we had made kind of piecemeal changes, but this is kind of a whole new fresh start. And what I think it represents is not a major change in direction from our policy perspective, but a more succinct and direct distillation of the values of our community. I think it gives better clarity in terms of future land use decisions and other aspects of the general plan related to like resource allocation and long-term planning issues and affordable housing and economic development. All of those features, I think, are better presented in a way that resonated a lot with the people that we got input with our county council, and I think better reflects the community values today.
Yeah, so what do you see those community values as being?
I think it's really prioritizing the quality of life that we have here and preserving as much as we can the character of the community. So the county feels like, you know, our role is as responsible stewards for the rural agricultural heritage of our valley, and doing the things that we can do to make sure that we do preserve those as much as possible.
So it was an 18-month process to update it. It's something that I know communities like to try and adopt every decade or so. So do you think you're going to stay on top of it kind of going forward and try and do it a little more timely manner, or is 25 years enough?
Yeah, well, actually, like I said, we had made updates to it, many updates since the 2001. What we have structured this new general plan around, though, is around specific performance measures, with the idea that we would revisit those annually through the budgeting process and adjust any of the policy priorities or kind of next steps, and identify what are the things that we're doing in this budget that will help carry out specific goals or policy objectives within the general plan. So our hope is that this structure is more evergreen and allows it to morph with whatever policy priorities the council of the time has as they strive to implement those elements of the general plan.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit about how land use policy has changed in the last 2.5 decades based on what the county once had and what it has now?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing is it's again, not all that different from a policy perspective. You know, certain areas are zoned lower density, some are higher. Overall, the county, we have some relatively low density areas in our most rural and mountainous locations. And the highest densities are those ones where we have rural agricultural uses. This general plan doesn't enact code changes. That's kind of the next step of this process, and will be a perpetual process of how we update our code. So we don't have new zones yet, but overall, I think the land use map is not that different from what it looked like in our previous general plan. What I think it does a better job, though, of is communicating what the general plan's role is in those process and our overall intent for these. Our old general plan had maybe more specificity in some areas that kind of bound our hands in how we addressed kind of some very nuanced issues that are better addressed at a more granular level in the county code.
Okay, let's move on to preliminary municipalities. What's going on here? And I know that you had just heard that the Bear Canyon preliminary municipality was rejected.
Yeah. So this is some exciting news. There was a meeting last week in Wallsburg with that town and the surrounding areas, and two of state senators, Senator Stratton and Senator Winterton, raising some concerns about that. So yesterday we got word from the state that the Bear Canyon preliminary municipality, this is the one just kind of off of 189 in Provo Canyon, was rejected by the state. This was because they found that it didn't meet the criteria of being sufficiently contiguous, that there is a narrow connection between kind of two separate parts of the project, and that meant that it didn't comply with state code. So that preliminary municipality is not proceeding, something that the county, as the county, we're pleased to see. There is still another preliminary municipality in kind of the east side of the Heber Valley, north of Lake Creek Road. This is the Wasatch Highlands, kind of above the Sitla property. The ones that Wallsburg is concerned about was a one that was filed out in their valley over there. And because of the way the state code works, only the first two every year get in. They're concerned about kind of the long term of, well, is this coming back next year? And the county has that same concern.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. I mean, what does it mean to be rejected? I mean, do they get to go back and rework it, or and then resubmit it, or do they have to wait like another year?
You know, we have tried to figure out if this means that does someone else get to line up in the queue or not, and I don't know that yet. I think the Lieutenant Governor's office are the ones who make that determination of if that means there's only one this year or not. That would be our hope. But I think it does still present a risk in terms of this law is supposed to be a pilot program that sunsets in 2031. And the message from our county council is we should land the plane now, because we can already tell there are problems with this test program. And so Senator Winterton and Senator Stratton actually asked in that meeting with Wallsburg for a resolution from our council opposing this law. And so we'll be bringing back to the council in August as a resolution encouraging the state to repeal this law and stop the pilot program.
Mm-hmm. So does the new general plan address those kind of things like preliminary municipalities that basically supersede the county's authority?
Yeah, and that's one of the big concerns that we have, and something that's been expressed to us is if there is something like this, we would prefer that instead it conforms with the general plan. Because we did a robust public engagement process. We feel like our general plan reflects our community's values and includes our long-term planning for density in areas and how it affects all of the residents around those areas. We would rather, if there was a preliminary municipality, it would comply with our general plan at least, right? If we were planning on development some area, then if the state wants to add tools to make that happen, that's maybe more acceptable to us than them just upending what our community feels like is the right set of balances across the densities of our areas.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, since only of these, as the pilot program kind of lays out, only two of these preliminary municipalities can be approved every year. My guess is that it's something lots of people are working on now to get it submitted in January. It's based on a first-come, first-serve process. So, I mean, while you'd like to see the program landed, I mean, any thoughts about how that could change? I mean, so that it balances the development across the state and, you know, not getting piled on Wasatch County?
Yeah. I mean, the Wasatch back, you know, there was an attempted preliminary municipality just on the other side of our boundary with Summit County and Browns Canyon. And I think we will continue to see this type of pressure, primarily, in my view, because the land values are so high and the house values are so high, there's a significant profit margin. And I think overall, as the county council, we feel like there was kind of this Trojan horse of this affordable housing argument, when I think affordable housing is not a good fit in many of these locations and not actually feasible. And there's just so many problems with it. And that's the justification that is being given for why we need several hundred more homes that are very high end so that we can get maybe a small handful of arguably affordable units. I just don't think that that's a reality. I think we would be better served by more specific targeting on affordable housing issues than just this type of broad brush development incentive.
Okay. So have you heard about any other perhaps potential preliminary municipalities coming your way?
I think the ones that we're aware of, you know, we'll be watching for what happens in January with the Bear Canyon. I suspect that they may try to resubmit. I think it's Smooth Hollow is the one that was in the Walsburg area. Obviously, they'll be competing with other potential preliminary municipalities, but we hope that the state can make a change to this program and just stop the process. Because I think even the first ones that started are still encountering major struggles and lawsuits because this is just a bad state code.
So any interim session that would happen between now and then?
You know, I think the state obviously felt like this was a worthwhile program. So it will take a lot of coordination with multiple representatives, I think, to make this type of change. My impression is that as some of the changes in the legislature through this election process go through, that we may see a shift in tenor in, you know, a number of issues. I think especially since the Stratus project has affected, you know, a statewide attention on development issues, I think the tone has shifted a little bit of, hey, maybe the state is being too aggressive in some of these areas and needs to pull the reins back. And that's why I hope we can kind of ride that wave and get to a better place.
Okay. And from last week's meeting, any direction on the discussion of updates to the 2019 Heber City Expansion Area Memorandum of Understanding to further protect the North Fields?
Yeah, I think we're interested in continuing to pursue how we preserve the North Fields. The next steps in that process is meeting with Heber City, so that we can kind of hammer out some more of those details. There's just a wide variety of issues that we're trying to tackle. And the discussion from last week was, do we take this small step forward, and while we try and plan for some future bigger steps, or if not, and so we're going to coordinate with Heber City. I think right now we're all on the same page of what the end goal is. We just got to figure out how to fill the steps in between.
Yeah, and the county council last week also considered awarding the request for proposal for construction management of the addition to the Children's Justice Center. So I guess I remember when Wasatch County and Summit County partnered on this, but it sounds, I know that Summit County then went on its own, and Wasatch County went ahead and built its own justice center?
Yeah, so Wasatch County built a Children's Justice Center, I want to say in the late 90s, largely with volunteered effort and donated materials. And we've been operating a Children's Justice Center for a while. We do partner, and I believe we still partner, with Summit County on how we handle interviews and some of the administration aspects. But what we're looking at here is expanding that facility that was built in the 90s to increase its capacity in a few key areas, one of them being meeting space. The other is ADA accommodations to the basement so that we can potentially provide in the future, medical services or other things like that in a facility that would be more ideal way to function that CJC.
Okay. Anything else, Dustin, you wanted to mention?
No, not this morning.
Okay. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
For One Night Only, Park City Film presenting the film Best Day Ever, happening Saturday night at the Jim Sani Auditorium. It's a documentary that follows adaptive mountain bikers Greg Durso and Ali Bianchi. Unfortunately, Greg was unable to join us this morning, but on the phone I have the co-founder of the Kelly Brush Foundation, and one of those also featured in the film, Kelly Brush. Good morning. Thanks for joining us, Kelly.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, so before we talk about the film, maybe we could talk just a little bit about you and get a bit of background about your foundation and its role in this film.
Yeah, absolutely. So I had a accident. I was a ski racer and had a ski racing accident back in 2006 when I was 19. I fell and hit a lift tower and broke my back. And after that accident, I was paralyzed from the chest down and used a wheelchair full time. And I wanted to make something good come out of my accident. And so I started the Kelly Brush Foundation to help people with spinal cord injuries get out and be active, as well as to make sure that ski racing is as safe as it can possibly be. And we've been working over the last 20 years to fulfill that mission. And we do that mission all over the country. We've helped over 2,000 people purchase adaptive sports equipment. And we work in all sorts of different areas to help people get into adaptive sports, as well as to make our recreational spaces accessible to people with disabilities.
All right. So how are you funded? Just with grants and donations?
Yeah, pretty much. So we're a nonprofit organization, and we do fundraising all through the year. So some of that is through private grants, but a lot of it is through fundraising, just private donations from individuals. We have different fundraising events. We have one coming up in Park City actually this weekend, and we have them all over the country in order to raise money to do the work that we do.
Okay, where are you based out of?
So we're based out of Vermont, which is where I live and where I lived when I got hurt. But we have, and that's where about half of our employees live, and our other employees are spread out across the country. And like I said, our work is all over.
Yeah. So the film, as I noted, is called Best Day Ever. It'll be shown Saturday night, 7 p.m. at the Jim Sante Auditorium. I believe there was going to be a Q&A and reception in the community room afterwards. Will Greg be able to make that, or?
Unfortunately, Greg has a broken leg and is having lots of problems with it, so he's not going to be able to make it out there, which is really too bad. But we still hope that we're going to have representatives from the Kelly Brush Foundation and other people from the film that you can learn a lot more about the film, because it's a really cool story, and it's a story that's around Greg and Allie's stories. And as anybody who sees the film, you'll see the involvement of the Kelly Brush Foundation as well. Greg runs all the programs at the Kelly Brush Foundation and has worked with us for several years. He was a grant recipient of ours shortly after he had his accident. And he's gotten two grants from us, one to get a bike so he can complete an Ironman, and one to get a ski so he's skied all over the world. And it follows Allie's story, who had a mountain bike accident, and she wanted to get back to mountain biking, and the Keller Brush Foundation helped her do that, both through a camp that we put on to help her learn about mountain biking, but also through helping her purchase the bike that she needed to use, which is, this equipment is incredibly expensive to get back out on the trails.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is a really fascinating one, and it talks a lot about these stories of Greg's and Allie's and the Keller Brush Foundation, but it also really is about the trails and what it means to get back out, and why that's important, but what it actually takes to make trails that work for adaptive mountain bikes, because that's something that a lot of people don't know, and there's a lot of... it's a really interesting look at what that actually means.
Yeah, I believe that you also have kind of a role in this film as well.
Yeah, so my role is mostly around sort of the work that we do through the Keller Brush Foundation. The other part that I am in this film is around Allie's story, and that, you know, I was connected to Allie very early on after her accident. I think it was, you know, day two or three after she got hurt. And I was FaceTiming with her when she was in the ICU. And, you know, what you'll see in the film is around her desire to be a mom and how much she wanted to be a mom for her whole life and how worried she was after she got hurt that that wasn't going to be possible and she's never going to be able to be a mom. And that was sort of her biggest dream. And she was able to talk to me a couple days after I got her number, and I spoke with her, which I do with a lot of people who have new injuries, and I told her about my kids, and I've got two girls who are 7 and 10 now, and, you know, I had them after I had my accident and the journey that I went through, and that it's totally possible for her, and that really helped her and changed her perspective, and that was, you know, for her, she, you know, says it was an incredibly powerful moment for her in a time that was really, really hard, all of a sudden having to deal with an injury and having your life turned upside down, to have something like that, to know that she can still be a mom, that she can still have a family, was really helpful for her.
Yeah. And adaptive mountain bikes, as you noted, are expensive, but have also evolved tremendously. Can you talk a little bit about how they work and what they've made possible for riders with spinal cord injuries?
Yeah, for sure. So just like mountain biking has grown as a sport overall in the last probably 10, 15 years, same thing with adaptive mountain biking. You know, it started with a guy in his garage who was sort of welding some stuff together because he had a spinal cord injury and wanted to figure out how to get out on the mountain, and he started making bikes for other people, and it's now grown into an industry where it's so high tech and the bikes are incredible and really cool. So basically the way they work, most of the bikes have three wheels. They have two wheels in the front and one wheel in the back. For a lot of them, you pedal them with your arms. Some of them have just a throttle that you use, and then you articulate the bike and steer it through moving the bike around. They all have electronic assist, which allows you to actually get over obstacles and go up trails that you wouldn't otherwise be able to do with the power of just your arms. And allows you to bike with anybody. So I love to mountain bike, and I go out and bike with my family all the time and ride with able-bodied riders. And it's an incredible experience. I love doing it. And the equipment is, you know, for these bikes are anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000. And that's obviously incredibly prohibitive for people who have disabilities and already have a higher cost of living. So being able to access the sport is there's a lot of barriers, and it's nice to be able to help and support anybody with a disability to get out and get on the trails, because we know how important that is, and getting out in the mountains and off the pavement is really hard for somebody who uses a wheelchair, and having access to that is so important.
You also mentioned it a little bit earlier just about trail accessibility. Does any trail work for an adaptive bike, or are they need to be built differently?
So it's a really good question, and it's a great part of the film that you'll see in the film if anybody sees that. So all trails do not work for adaptive bikes. So as I said, you know, most of them have three wheels, two in the front, and those two wheels are wider than what a regular bike is. So there's only a few things that need to happen to make trails adaptive friendly. And one of them is that they need to be wide enough. I can still ride on sort of what we think classically as single track, but we just can't have pinch points like two rocks that are really narrow or two trees that I can't fit through. So there's things like that. There's things like having camber on the trail where the trail, you know, is really isn't flat and is off camber. When that happens, then my bike gets tippy, and so then I would tip over, and that doesn't work for an adaptive bike. So there's a few different things like that that you think about. What we have found, though, is that really a lot of trails work really well for adaptive bikes for the most part, and there's just a few things that need to change. And one of the biggest misconceptions that people have about trails that are adaptive friendly is that they're easier. And really, the point that we like to make in Best Day Ever is that they're really not easier trails. They're just trails that work well for all bikes. And what we've found is that when we make trails adaptive friendly, when you change little things here and there that are obstacles or barriers for adaptive bikes, it actually makes the trails better for everybody. And we get that feedback over and over. And that's, I think that's the biggest takeaway, that adaptive friendly doesn't mean easy. It just means that it works well for all bikes.
Yeah.
And this is work that we're doing in Vermont as well as in Utah and all over the country to assess trails and make sure that they work for adaptive bikes and to give feedback on how to make them work better.
Now, I'm aware of a couple of trails built in the Round Valley area near the National Ability Center. Porcupine and Down Dog were actually built as adaptive trails. I fear, though, that they've been ridden so much by able-bodied athletes that they've kind of changed. I mean, they're right. I mean, when it gets dusty, more rocks get exposed and maybe not as adaptable as they used to be. Does that happen? You need to kind of just make sure that they are maintained for adaptability.
It depends on what the intention of the trail is. So if there is a trail that's intended to be for beginner riders, whether they're adaptive riders or able-bodied riders, if they start to get beat up and there's more exposed rocks and there's more obstacles that are not really the intention of a trail that's a green trail or whatever it is, then I think it's worth thinking about how can we make sure that we keep these trails for that intention. But I think for many trails, that kind of obstacle for a more intermediate or advanced rider are totally fine to manage, and an adaptive bike can manage that as well. You know, the bike network, the riding network that's featured in Best Day Ever, it's called the Driving Range, and there are trails everywhere, anywhere from blue to double black diamond trails on that. And as you can imagine, there's lots of exposed rock, there's lots of exposed roots. And those are all manageable by adaptive bikes, but it just depends on the intention of the trail. And so those trails, yes, around the National Ability Centers are awesome and really great learning terrain. And I think it's just maintaining what the intention of the trail is, whether it's for adaptive bikes or whether it's for everybody. And really, I think the hope is that, and this is work that we do through the Kelly Brush Foundation, is that this is all inclusive, right? So it's not meant for, these trails are made for adaptive bikes and these trails are made for two-wheeled able-bodied bikes. Yeah. It's really that recreation is inclusive, so that everybody is riding together. When I go ride my bike, I want to ride with my kids and my family and my friends. I don't want to have to go somewhere different than where they're going.
Yeah. Okay, again, the film Best Day Ever will be shown at the Jim Sandy Auditorium Saturday night, 7 p.m. Tickets are $25. Is this a fundraiser then for the foundation?
This is. So proceeds will go to the Kelly Brush Foundation to support the work that we're doing. We have a bike ride on Sunday also that people can attend. That's road and gravel ride. There'll be adaptive riders there, so you can see the adaptive bikes in action. And kellybrushfoundation.org, you can find out more information about that ride too.
Okay. Kelly, I appreciate your time this morning. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Kelly Brush, co-founder of the Kelly Brush Foundation. Again, Best Day Ever, the film, 7 p.m. Saturday night. You can go to parkcityfilm.org to purchase tickets there. In the studio with an update from Recycle Utah and a preview of some upcoming events, I have Executive Director Andy Heck. Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Wasatch Back.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some of the events and programs coming up over the next couple months that you want the community to know about. That's starting with, is that today or tomorrow?
Tomorrow,
yeah. The film screening of the Plastic Detox.
Yeah, exactly. So this is part of our Zero Waste Wasatch Back group. They've partnered with this film, The Plastic Detox, and Jim Santee Auditorium from 6 to 8 tomorrow. Sounds like it'll be a great screening.
Okay, free?
It also happens to be my wife's birthday tomorrow, so I just want to give a big shout out. Happy birthday, Brittany.
Okay, so is it a free screening? Anybody?
It is.
Okay,
yep.
So you can go online and reserve a ticket if you need to. Then coming up next month, you've got your 11th annual 100-mile meal.
Yeah, we have one event next week that I'd love to mention first, however. This is an event we started a couple months ago. It's just kind of an impromptu event. Everyone who's listening to KPCW, you know Recycle Utah. We are all a community together. So show up for this one. It's fun. Just right after work, right about 5 o'clock, we pull out our big green egg. We have a really nice barbecue down at Recycle Utah, and we host a little gathering of friends and family for Recycle Utah. That's next week, Tuesday next week. Bring hamburgers, bring some beverages, come and have fun.
Okay, so people just need to bring whatever they're going to eat and chairs?
And chairs. Oh, what a great point. Yes, we have a few chairs, but yeah, bring a lawn chair.
Okay, and starting at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, right about 5. No hard time. It's a low-key event, but it's a really fun community event.
All right. Yeah, I remember you used to actually have live music in the parking lot as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'd never got to attend any of those events, but okay. having community barbecue is really pulls everything together.
All right. Then we can talk about the 100-mile meal that's happening August 22nd.
Yeah, one of our biggest events over the year. This is the 11th annual 100-mile meal. I think this event is super special, and I'll tell you a couple reasons why. Number one, just the event itself. All the food sourced for the meal is sourced within 100 miles of Park City. Everything that's on your plate, it comes together. Vail does an amazing job. Their chefs love to be on that dinner because they get to be creative. They think outside of the box with the ingredients that are brought to them, and they make an amazing meal. And we sit down and we enjoy. It's an intimate gathering. We only have 200 spots total, so it does sell out. Tickets are on sale right now. But the other reason this is a really special event for the 100-mile meal, particularly this year, is we'll finally have some public drawings, images, plans we can share of our new facility, the new direction of Recycle Utah. We are excited to share with our community the direction Recycle Utah is going, and this is finally the chance we get to open up and show everyone.
Okay. Tickets are how much?
Tickets are $300 to the dinner. However, because we are so excited to share everything we've got, we wanted to increase the capacity of this event. We couldn't increase above the 200 limit. The food is definitely the limiting factor there, so we were really hard capped. It is at Red Pine Lodge, so we had some options, and we decided to go with a party after the dinner. So there's a separate ticket online for sale. Again, limited tickets, get them before they go. We're calling it the Recycle Utah Rendezvous. So the 100-mile meal will go till 7 o'clock, and at 7 o'clock to 10 o'clock, the Recycle Utah Rendezvous will come. Come up to the Red Pine Gondola, ride on up to Red Pine Lodge, get a few drinks, have fun, see where Recycle Utah is going in the future, and then get home safely and have a great evening.
Okay, so it's basically $100 for a ticket, and you get a couple of cocktails?
Yep, it'll be a fantastic party.
All right, and when are you going to kind of show that reveal of the drawings of the new facility?
Well, we're still working on the program specifics. We'll have a program set for the dinner portion of the evening, and then we'll have something incredibly fun to unveil during the lively party afterwards.
Okay. Any other new educational workshops or sustainability initiatives happening this summer?
No, we're deep into summer camps. Every week we have between 3 and 5 summer camps that we go out to and work with the kids, the staff, and talk about sustainability and reduction and things like that. We also, to put on everyone's radar, it's just a community everyone needs to know, is the Household Hazardous Material Collection Day is September 26th. I know this is pretty far out, but I wanted to put this on everyone's calendar. If you're a visual person, like a lot of us, this is always on our website, recycleutah.org. But September 26th at Silver King Lot at Park City Mountain, we'll collect all the hazardous waste that collects around our house. And then the other really big one that people want to know is Dumpster Days. Dumpster Days, October 8th, 9th, and 10th. And that's the one where you bring all of your yard waste and anything else that needs to go to the dump, and you separate it, and then we take care of it from there.
All right. Well, I know that you're doing your big reveal on August 22nd, but what can you tell us about where the project stands today?
Oh, it's really moving forward. We have the best people in the room talking about these things. Specifically, getting into the kind of the weeds here, we were able to send a big document back to our architect. We had one set of drawings early on. This got everyone really excited. We took a deep dive on what the functions of that building were going to be. We really thought in terms of what does this building say about the mission of who we are and what we're trying to do. And that led us to really good discussions on, okay, there might be some changes that need to happen. We sent those back to our architect, who was incredibly excited to see that level of detail because now he has a better direction. And we are expecting those next set of drawings to come back to us shortly before our next board meeting in 3 weeks or so.
All right. So the organization has been asking residents what they'd like to see in the new center. I mean, mm-hmm. What have you heard about so far? What do people want to see?
Oh, you know, I did not look over those notes mm-hmm. before I got here. It was the things that really surprised us that led us down the road of what do we need to lean into? Yes, we are a recycling center. That is the heart of what we do. We divert material from entering the landfill. And we divert a lot of material for entering the landfill. But the parts that came in were that were nice to hear because we kind of knew this, but it was good to get some data to back it up, was fix-it labs, education space on the property. You know, we educate so many kids, and we don't have a good place to educate them at the center to show them what happens to all this stuff. More community aspect of what Recycle Utah is.
Yeah, and you've talked a little bit in the past about expanding that food waste collection. Is that something that you hope to see as well?
Yeah, so we talk with Momentum quite a bit. Momentum is the experts in food waste collection. Currently, all of our food waste is going down to an anaerobic digester. Recycle Utah will have a part to play in that, but it'll probably be more something of a larger amount of us to be able to collect and then pass on to Momentum. We won't be able to do any processing. However, I have been researching a little thing called Chompy, which you and I have seen in the past up in Bellevue, Washington. Just had a good meeting with the executive director up there and got in contact with the person who is actually running Chompy, and we're learning a lot of things about that.
Okay, so what's the timeline from here? I mean, best case scenario, when do you begin construction?
Yeah, best case scenario. So we are out of our current facility in March. That is a hard deadline. Obviously, no building is going to be completed by March of next year. We're still working through some permitting and things like that. So we're hoping that it's possible to get some shovels in the ground around March. But we will find ourselves in a temporary facility on our new property from March and probably through that summer. So through next summer, we'll be in a temporary facility, some sort of tent, while our main warehouse is constructed. And best case scenario is then we can work out of that warehouse while the other buildings and components are finished around us.
Sure. So, I mean, are you going to have a concrete pad then for this temporary facility?
You know, there's a lot of TBD on that. Mm-hmm. But I got to tell you, we've got some of the best people in the room working with us. We've got everyone from architects to developers to we have experts working with us.
All right. And of course, building a new facility is a significant investment. How is the capital campaign progressing? I haven't heard much about it.
There's been a lot of talk internally because we're not quite ready to go, hey, this is what we're looking for. Once the next set of drawings come back of what the facility and the future of Recycle Utah is going to look like, then we can really do some cost analysis and figure out how much this is going to cost. And then we can come up with a real figure. I can tell you that everything that we are looking at and doing is very exciting and very reasonably priced for the impact we are going to create for the county. I'm really excited to show what we're going to be doing and how we're going to be doing it soon.
Okay, Andy, anything else you wanted to mention?
No, just a great community. Thank you to everyone who supports us. Remember that Recycle Utah is a nonprofit. We do rely on your donations. You can always donate on our website at recycleutah.org.
Okay, and people can get tickets for the rendezvous or for the dinner there as well.
Absolutely.
All right, Andy Hecht is the executive director of Recycle Utah. July is Disability Pride Month, and the local business community is partnering with the National Ability Center and Park City Chamber to launch a new accessibility program with Wheel the World. One of the goals of the Chamber's Sustainable Tourism Plan is to make it simpler for those with disabilities to navigate local businesses and events. Chamber CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff says their vision is to be the most sustainable destination in the world. Partnering with Wheel the World, she says, is a big step in that direction.
And truly, you can't claim that while leaving out a huge portion of travelers, people with mobility challenges, sensory disabilities, chronic conditions, and those travelers consistently tell us that they struggle to find good information about whether a place, whether it's a hotel, a restaurant, an activity, an attraction, if those places really work for people with disabilities. This program, Wheel the World, it helps us close that gap.
So far, 30 local businesses are participating in the program with the help of the National Ability Center and Wheel the World, which verifies these hotels, restaurants, and attractions with on-site accessibility assessments.
It's a verified third party that comes in with their measuring tape, and they actually measure how wide the windows are, how high the steps are, how accessible your business is. We're launching this year with 30 businesses. Our goal is to add 30 businesses every year. So by the time 2034 and beyond comes around, we have over 250 businesses that are Wheel the World verified.
On Thursday, the 30 founding businesses will celebrate the launch of the program here in Park City.
We're really proud to have a panel of folks with disabilities to talk to us about the challenges that they have in traveling so that our community can better understand the importance of having a welcoming and inclusive and accessible destination.
Wheel the World was created to provide accessible, stress-free group tours around the world designed specifically for those who are mobility challenged.